We're going to do two things. You can see the theme is Christian apologetics in today's world. What is apologetics? And why is it essential for the church in our time and place? So that's two different questions. What is apologetics? And why is it essential? So I will divide our time here. I will first give a presentation to try to answer the first question, what is apologetics? And then we have some time for dialogue. And then I will try to answer the second question, why is it essential? What is apologetics? The English word apologetics goes back to a Greek word, apologia, which you can find 18 times in the New Testament. It's generally translated to defend or to answer, apologia. This word has its background in the court of antiquity. So in the court, there was a prosecutor. So like today, someone presenting the accusation. We think you have murdered Mr. X. And then the argument for the accusation. That was called a kategoria in Greek. A kategoria, the accusation. But then, the accused person had the right to present an apologia. No, I not murdered Mr. X. At the time of the murder, I was over here, several hours away, and I have a number of people who can confirm that when Mr. X was killed here, I was over there. I'm innocent. So you make a defense. The word apologia appears in the book of Acts a number of times where Paul stands up to make his apologia, his defense, in front of the authorities. The most well-known place of those 18 places in the New Testament where apologia is used is 1 Peter 3:15, which is a well-known verse on apologetics. There Peter says, "Always be prepared to give an apologia, an answer, to everyone who asks you to give the reason." And there's another Greek word you can understand even if you have not studied Greek. To give the logos, the reason for the hope that you have. This letter is written not only to pastors or leaders, but to the church. And Peter says we should always be prepared to answer everyone, really a general, always and everyone. And in order to do that, of course, we need to prepare ourselves. So we are prepared to give an apologia for the hope that we have. So Peter is underlining that aspect of the Christian faith, the hope, which is really fundamental, the hope that we have. And of course, all through history, there have been objection towards the hope. How on earth can you have that hope? That there is a continuation of life after your biological death. You Christians, don't you know what happens when you die? When your heart stops beating, the activity in the brain is gone. Immediately, the process of your body just decomposes and becomes part of the biological system, and the cells in your body becomes part of an insect or of the grass. Or how can you have a hope that there is a continuation, that you will live on? And even live on, ultimately, in a bodily form? That's a good question. How on earth can we have that hope? So what do we say? What's an answer to that objection? How can we have a hope of a future beyond our grave?
We have faith.
We have faith. We have faith, but that in itself does not change much.
And we have God's revelation in the Bible.
We have God's revelation in the Bible, and you said? Yeah, there's something interesting. the resurrection. Anything more?
We believe that the resurrection did happen because of this is a fact from history.
Yeah, it's an effect of history. You can look into the evidences. Yeah.
Are we more than just our body?
We are more than just our bodies. Yeah. So we believe in a soul, a spiritual dimension of the human being, yeah. You can also zoom out and start with the even bigger issue to say to the person asking the question, if there is no God, I totally agree with you. There is no hope. There is no future. I see the logic of your position. If there is no God, it's impossible for there to be a future for me individually. Life ends with biological death. I'm with you if there is no God. But you need to see the logic of my position. I believe there is a creator God who has created the whole universe and who is the reason behind my existence. If God really exists, it's not impossible for him to let me continue after my biological death. And it's not even impossible for him to let me have, ultimately, a bodily future. And you need to see the logic of my position. It is built upon the presupposition of there being a God. And if you want to discuss what's the arguments for God, we can do that. But the Christian faith is built upon that starting point. And secondly, which was the thing you mentioned here, if you go to chapter 1 in 1 Peter, verse 3, he has given the reason why we have this hope. So 1 Peter 1, verse 3. So he says there, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope. How? Through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So what is possible because there is a God has actually happened in history. One person have come back from biological death to an immortal human bodily existence, and that is Jesus Christ. So, of course, that is the ultimate answer for us on that question, but it's built upon there being a God. I work with a very non-academic definition of apologetics. I think we can say this. Apologetics is about explaining what we believe, that is the content, what we believe. And nowadays, people in Europe, they have no clue about the content. So we need to explain, what do we mean by God? What do we mean by sin? And so on. What we believe, the content, and then defend why we believe it, and that is the truth. Why do we believe that content instead of something else? Why are we not secular humanists? Why don't we bow down before Allah and confess Muhammad as his prophet? Why don't we think everything is divine, the whole universe is divine, and we should melt into this divine, impersonal reality? Why are we disciples of Jesus Christ? So, explain what we believe and defend why we believe. In Sweden, that rhymes, so it's really easy to remember. Förklara, försvara. Explain and defend. What about Danish? Can you say the same? Yeah, so you have it in Danish too, so that's easy to remember. You can give a lot more academic, sophisticated definition of apologetics if you want, but for me this is a good working definition to explain what we believe and defend why we believe what we believe. If you study the book of Acts, you can see that this attitude is there all over the place. In all of the speeches, there is an apologetic dimension. Here is Paul in Thessalonica in Acts 17. Paul went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead. "This Jesus I'm proclaiming to you is the Messiah," he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks and quite a few prominent women. So great success. A lot of people are coming to faith. Number of the Jews, huge numbers of Gentiles, and also some high-status women. It's Luke who's giving us this description. And he's using five verbs to describe what Paul did. And if I take away all the other text, you can see the five verbs. He reasoned with them. Explaining and proving. Sounds like apologetics in my ears. Explaining and proving, defending. And then he's proclaiming it. And people are persuaded about the truth. He reasoned with them. He explained. He proved, of course, not in a mathematical sense or a scientific sense. You cannot prove anything like that. But he really showed the truth of his message. And then he proclaimed it, and people were persuaded. Of course, not all were persuaded. So some are really hostile, and Paul had to flee from Thessalonica for his life. They want to kill him. So he leave Thessalonica. Some of his co-workers stay and help the new converts to form a church. He comes down to Berea. And this is actually an inscription from Berea, which was at the time of Paul. That's from a gymnasium and a school for athletes. So Paul could have had his hand on this, just felt it. There it says, he goes to the synagogue, and the Jews there, they receive the message with great eagerness and examine the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. As a result, many of them believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men. Obviously, Paul had an open attitude here, saying, "You don't have to take this on my words. You can investigate the message for yourself." So he's taking a step back and saying, "Read the scriptures." And they, after work every day, they meet in the synagogue, starting the first Alpha course in world history, going through scriptures to see, is this message true? And when they do it, they see it is true. So they examined the scriptures to see if it's true. So a lot of people are coming to faith here. The rumor of that goes back to Thessalonica. They are sending a mob of people to try to kill Paul in Berea, so he has to flee again. He leaves one of his co-workers in Berea, and now he's on his own and he's coming down to Athens. He goes to the synagogue, Luke tells, but we have no information on what's happening there, because now Luke's focus is not on the synagogue, as just told us about a number of synagogue presentations from Paul. Now Paul is in the marketplace. And now his apologetic approach is very different, but it's still apologetic, of explaining and defending. Here, he meets polytheists, believing in many, many small gods, like Zeus and Hermes and all the others. He also meets sophisticated philosophers, and they are named Epicureans and Stoics. Epicureans saying that God has withdrawn. Practically, we can be atheists. We will never meet the gods. We are on our own. When we die, everything is over. And Stoics, who were more like Eastern mystics, saying everything is part of the divine. The whole universe is divine, including us as human beings. In those dialogues, so he has dialogues in the marketplace, and he's then invited to give a formal presentation before the Areopagus, the council. He does not quote scriptures because they don't know the scripture, and it's not an authority for them. So he quotes the Greek poets, to relate to his listeners, two different Greek poets. And in his speech, he makes a really powerful worldview critique, critiquing the politists, saying, you cannot think of God in terms of small beings that we need to serve, who lives in a temple and needs our attention. No, God is the creator of heaven and earth and sea and everything in it. And he says to the Epicureans, God has not withdrawn. He is close to every one of us. It's in him we live and move and have our being. He's not far removed. And to the Stoics, he's presenting a personal living God, God who is guiding human history, who's created everyone out from one first man and then guided history. So he's a personal God. And then he's moving his whole speech to the climax of history. This God will one day judge us. And the judge is already appointed, and then he looks back into history, and it's proved by God raising him from the dead. If we could go through all the different speeches in Acts and see the same pattern, Paul worked as an apologist. So it's important to see that cultural context is really crucial. Paul worked very differently in the synagogue and in the marketplace. If you think of Jesus, that's the same. Have you ever noticed the contrast between John 3 and John 4? John 3, Jesus is really tough in relationship to Nicodemus, highly educated theologian. And he really shakes him. You are the teacher of Israel and don't understand this. Come on, man. You know, challenging him. And then next chapter, he's tender and soft and walks very slowly with the Samaritan woman because her situation is so different. So obviously, Jesus took context really serious. And we need to do that. In light of this, I'm thinking of apologetics not as a set of arguments. Some people have that misunderstanding, that apologetics is a set of arguments, for example, very philosophical arguments for the existence of God. Now, I affirm those kind of arguments. They're really interesting. But you cannot limit apologetics to a set of arguments. It's something much broader. So I like to talk about apologetics in terms of a culture amongst us as Christians. It is an attitude that we are open and willing to explain and defend the gospel, whatever kind of questions people bring up or want to discuss. And I think there is an urgent need of creating that kind of culture within the Christian church, that we are a community of people, community of believers, with this attitude. We are interested in truth. We are open to discuss all aspects of truth, and we are willing to dialogue with any kind of questions. Any honest question should have an honest answer. So in my thinking, apologetics should be an integral part of the church and its mission. It should be an integral part of the church and its mission. It's not a kind of nerdy thing for some philosophical geeks. It's a much broader thing of loving God with your whole mind. The second question on the needs for apologetics in our time and place has a very obvious answer, but let's try to spell it out, the specific needs in our time. This is the World Value Survey. It's updated regularly. It is a way of trying to understand some basic aspects of the different cultures of the world. There are two axes. So on that axis is traditional versus secular values. So traditional, that is always religious. So if the culture is religious, it's down, or if it's more secular, it's up. And this axe is survival versus self-expression. So survival, then the culture is still basically striving for survival in terms of food and clothing and housing and safety and so on. And that forces people also to cling closer together in terms of family and tribe and clan and so on. And if you basically have solved those problems, you can go on to focus on self-expression, becoming individualistic. Okay, so you see something really interesting. Europe is high up on secularism and far out on individualism. And the Protestant Europe is highest up, further out. And my little country, and we are some Scandinavians here, we are so really secular and really individualistic. Here's the two main challenges we have in our culture. You can discuss all kinds of issues relating to this kinds of global survey, but it obviously is showing some real tendencies here. What does it mean that a culture becomes secular? Well, the word itself is a Latin word from seculum, which means time. It means time, but it has come to denote, to mean when you focus on this time, not eternity, this world, not a spiritual world. So it's this world, it's here and now. It's not eternity, it's not the coming kingdom, it's not God and a spiritual world. It's here, it's now, it's this world. So when a culture becomes secular, that becomes the dominant perspective. And this is, of course, so ironic that Europe is the most secular of all the continents in the world. Because historically, all over Europe, you have had those majestic cathedrals. Some places, for 2,000 years, the Christian faith has been there. In my country, far up in the north, for more than 1,000 years. And this is, of course, symbols of people saying, there is another world, there is pointing towards heaven. There is a God, there is a creator, and on the top of the church there is a cross. This God has come down to us in Jesus Christ who have died for us. So they are symbols of the foundation of our culture. And now those churches are empty and are closed down in so many places and are sold to become entertainment houses or mosques in some places. Why did this happen? Why have we become so secular? Complex historical issue, but one of the main reasons is what's happening during what we call the Enlightenment, where the intellectual elite in our culture, philosophers, some scientists, some artists, started to say, we cannot believe in Christianity, in the biblical perspective any longer. And they started to raise criticism from a huge number of angles, intellectual questions. We cannot believe in that kind of God, in a Trinity who's created everything. Scientifically, we don't need a creator. We have started to solve a lot of issues. We understand now much more about nature. Scientifically, we don't need God. Historically, they said, sorry, but these texts do not relate to real events. This is legend and myth and saga. It has not happened, sorry. This is just a human book amongst other human books. There came critique towards the Christian morality. It's too narrow. It's not liberating. It's imprisoning people. And institutionally, the church as a political factor, as a corrupt institution. And on that point, they had really some truths. It needed to be criticized, the institutional church, absolutely. But on the other points, the critique was not as valid as it was seen. But unfortunately, gradually the whole culture had taken over that kind of critical perspective. For a long time, it was the intellectual elite that did not affect the European culture. So we had strong revivals during the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, because it was still the intellectual elite only thinking like that. The population at large kept kind of Christian perspective. But you can say after the Second World War, the perspective of the intellectual elite took over the educational system and gradually the whole culture went that way. When my father, so that's just one generation away, when he grew up, he and his contemporaries went 6 years in school and then off to work. That was the majority of people. During those 6 years, every day in school started with prayer. God was in the classroom every day. The Bible, Luther, Christian faith was there during those 6 years. Now, in Sweden, more than 50% go to university. So they are within the educational system between 15 to 20 years. And that perspective is in the classroom every day during those long years. Unfortunately, the church has not woken up to this. The teaching in the church is the same, basically, as when my father grew up, not engaging in apologetics. And this has been such a disaster. It's not identical in all countries in Europe, but there is a similar process that culture have changed, but Christians have not changed enough, not changing the content of the faith, but changed in how we explain and defend the faith. So our culture becomes secular. When a culture becomes secular and God is kicked out of the picture, who then takes God's place? Well, can only be the individual. So now the individual human being is taking God's place, and that is the symbol of the International Secular Humanist Organization. It's their logo. It's called Happy Human. Finally, no God, I'm on the throne myself. I can define my life. Everything is now free. That is what they want to communicate. But you should notice, it's not a group of people. It is the individual. So what has happened after secularization is that we have become this extremely individualistic culture. From the beginning, people felt kind of euphoria. I'm totally free. But gradually, it had dawned upon people, what a horrible situation to be on your own. And there's no definition to life. You have to create your own meaning. You have to define yourself. And that's why young people now are on such a desperate search for who am I, looking inside to try to find out what is my true identity. And then people find, since we are fallen human beings, if you just go inside yourself, you will find so many strange things. But it all goes back to this process of dethroning God, becoming secular. Because we're secular, no one else than we as individuals can take God's place. And now we are running with that perspective. So there's been a need for apologetics in all different times and cultures, but I would say if there was any time a need for apologetics to explain and defend the faith, it is in our times. And we are just surrounded by objections and obstacles. So I've just mentioned some really classical objections, like science and evil and suffering, some more newer in terms of ethics, specifically in relationship to sexual ethics and identity questions. World religions, it was much easier when to think about the other religions as false when they were far away, but now all world religions are here at our doorstep. So the whole issue of how can you say that one religion is true and not the other has become much more acute. The Bible, so many of the churches has been undermined by liberal theology, not trusting the Bible any longer because of this critique. So, others that Christians are hypocritical, people are objecting towards a number of Christian doctrines like a coming judgment and so on. So there are questions from so many different perspectives. And we need to engage in conversations here. So that's my answer to the question. Do we need apologetics? Yes. We live in a very confusing culture. We have a Christian history, so there's some memory of Christianity. But now it's a really confused situation with secular humanism, liberal theology, a postmodern mindset, the really individualistic mindset, a growing presence of Islam, which is a totally new thing for us Europeans. But now in some places, 20% of the population are Muslims, and there are mosques coming up in so many different places. And then there are streams of interest in spirituality of different kinds. So really complex and challenging.